Hello, everybody. It's your friend Rick with another edition of the Blind Ambition podcast with Jack Kelly. We have a special episode for you this week. As you know, our goal at Blind is to get you a behind-the-scenes look into some of the top companies and insider knowledge of different industries. We want to equip you with advice you can actually use to level up your career and discover something new. So we're excited to have Jos Capito from the world of sport with us today. He's a longtime Formula One CEO. Recently, he was the CEO of Williams Racing and was previously the CEO of McLaren Racing. Now, I'll let Jack take it away.
As somebody who's a CEO of a racing team, wow, I mean, that's like a high-powered job with big highs, you know, low lows. Williams, you came in, usually successful, going to a racing team that's been having a little trouble. And how was it? How did it feel to take on the reins? And what did you do to try to turn everything around?
That starts with a good question. I think I was just 1 month before retiring,
right?
Before I joined Williams, and then I got the call from Doyle and said, can we talk about the CEO and team principal role for Williams? And as I said, it didn't take long for me to say yes. As a kid, I'm a Formula One fan. And you know that Williams is the second most successful team after Ferrari in the history of Formula One. So I thought if you take one challenge instead of go to retire, then this is the one, isn't it? And I've seen that Williams was struggling a lot. They've been fantastic in the past, but they had struggled a lot in the last couple of years. So I thought my combined experience in racing for all my life and also in the automotive industry, I thought it's the right combination to take this job on because it's also quite a huge responsibility. And I wouldn't have taken it on if I wouldn't have believed that I can be positive to the team and can make the team make a turnaround and get it better again. So if I wouldn't have been convinced that my experience would have a chance to succeed, then I wouldn't have taken it on.
Now, how did you, if you don't mind my asking, how did your wife and family feel about it? Did they say after 30 years, come on, let's take a vacation, retire, we'll enjoy ourselves? Or were they all for and said, yeah, just let's do it?
I think when I mentioned it, that that would be a chance, I think they were aware that they have no chance to talk against it.
They knew it's in your blood, right?
You have no chance. He will do it anyhow, and that's it, and we have to cope with it.
So for people who aren't familiar with Formula One or Williams, my understanding, and I'm a novice at this, Alejandro has taught me a lot about racing. So you can't come into a team that's been having some hard times. How do you turn it around? What do you do to keep people motivated? Because if you're not winning, it's so easy for people to get, you know, bummed out, depressed, want to leave, want to go to another team. Did you have a strategy to kind of turn things around?
No, I came into the team and had no idea. I just knew the results, but I didn't know anybody in the team. And I didn't know what the real issues are. Why they fell behind. I knew that they had financial issues. They didn't have the sponsorship and the money to invest and to keep the team up to speed compared to the other big teams. So that was clear, but that meant first coming in to listen a lot and to create confidence within everybody, and especially in the management. And to find out what the issues are. What made it think, what first you look at was through Corona. So I started February 2021 and I couldn't even join the team because I had to stay in Germany, couldn't go to the UK. So I could only join at the end of February. So starting with a new company, that's about 800 people, and you don't know anybody and you have to do it remote for a month and to create the basics. First, I thought it's nearly impossible to do and how you do it. So I read a couple of books and find out how have people done in the past, if CEOs come in the company, what they do, and try to find a solution how to do this remote. And I found the solution, one book that asked the management, everybody the same question, five same questions. And with this, I arranged then half an hour one-to-one team meetings with all the 80 employees of the management, and find then out where are commonalities and what is really good and where are the issues, and was listening then nearly for 1 month. And then coming to the team, I think I had a quite a good overview what the issues were, and was competent to discuss with the management what the issues are and how to move forward.
So what were some of the questions you asked them? So you come in there, right? They don't know you. You don't know them. You know, they know you from reputation, but you're learning. And I was watching the episodes with you on. You're all wearing masks, so it had to be super uncomfortable, you know, to communicate, you know, with masks. I saw one where you coming to the office and you just had to hit elbows instead of, so very tough times to come in there. So when you ask them questions, like what kind of questions should you ask to just being the new guy to feel out without like making you uncomfortable?
And they got all the questions, the five questions in writing for me up front. Mm-hmm. The first question was, what is great at Williams? The second question was, what you think should be changed? The third question was, what do you think you should change? The fourth question was, what's your advice for me to do? And the fifth question was, what you really want to tell me what I should not do?
The last one might be, the last one must be uncomfortable when you say like, okay, tell me what, you know, you should or shouldn't do. That has to be weird, like telling the CEO, okay, CEO, here's what you got to do. Like, did they give you honest answers, or do they pull their punches? What did they do?
Some said up front, I've got it in writing. Should I send you the answers before we have the Teams call? I said, no, I don't want it to be a monologue. I want it to be a discussion, and I want to see your face when you answer the question.
Oh, my God. This could be really uncomfortable.
I don't want to read it. Yeah. I don't want to read it. And seen quite a big number asked, can I be open and honest? And they say, if you are not open and honest,
what good is it?
You might not get what you want. So if you tell me everything is great, I won't change anything.
Oh my
and
God.
That's what you get. So and I think then that opened up, and people were pretty open and honest, as it was always. I think it was important to start with what is great at Williams. So it's not, oh, what's bad? What should we change? The first was, what's great?
Start with the positive. And
then, what's great at Williams? Why are you there? What do you like? What's great? And when you had the interviews with about 80 of my colleagues, and we could cluster it in results. So they were very much the same. So, and when you say that you have 60 to 70 or 80% the same things that are great, or 80% what should be changed, it's the same thing, then I think you can be pretty sure that this is really what's good and what has to be changed. And the answers were slightly different, but then I clustered it and say, what does it really mean? And I came up to was 4 to 5 points for each answer, for each question, the answers that they repeated. So, and I think that gave me a good overview. But the most important thing was to listen. And it's not just unprepared meetings, but I got the answers to the same questions independently. And looking back, I think that was even better than being on the spot, because you would never do this that disciplined on the spot, because people would come in, you have to be distracted, you have other things to do. So I could really focus for more than 3 weeks just on getting these introductions with us on the same basis. And looking back, I think I'm very happy that I found that solution.
See, that's not such a smart way to go about it, you know, to not come in there and say, okay, I'm the new boss. Here's what we're going to do. And I want you to do X. I want you to do Y and Z. And that's it. And then everybody's like, wow, who's this guy? What's going on? But instead, you just did the opposite. You came in there and said, hey, I'm the new guy. Tell me what's happening. What's good? What's not good? What should we work on? Yeah. What do we need to improve? You know, what are we strong at? And I'd imagine by doing that, you kind of get the morale up, right? Because then people start thinking, hey, this guy just really cares about the team and cares about us. And he's literally asking for our opinions, what to do. And he's, you know, the CEO. I feel flattered that he's asking, a little nervous because I don't want to say anything to rub him the wrong way, but I'm glad that he's asking. So did you feel by doing that, it kind of became more of an esprit de corps where people started getting a little bit more like, wait, this could be really cool?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's my experience. And I think the very much a German way is that somebody gets in and said, look, this is how we do it. Yeah. X, Y, Z. This is my experience. Yeah. Now go off and do it. But as I worked very international with various cultures and various companies and global companies, I found that this is the German way is not really the right way. At the end, you have to decide what to do, but you have to cite it within a team. It's all the teamwork. And to say first, to get an overview and not coming in and say, I have all the experience, I know everything, this is the way we do it now, and not respecting the competence that is there. And, you know, the companies are always, they are at the point where they are for a reason. So they have a history, there was a way to get there. And you have to know that way before you do the changes, because you work with the same people. And I never got in a company or in a department and just exchanged a lot of the people, because I always wanted to make the team good with who is there. And I think that's much more rewarding as a leader to make a team that is there successful instead of just reshuffling everything.
So you have a team that for decades was kind of the, you know, icon, you know, always winning. And just like in any sport, you're not going to always win. It's just, that's not how life works. You know, you're going to have ebb and flows. So you came on where, you know, for a while, things weren't as great as they were in the heyday. So how did you take what from the listening tour and people are saying, and then start implementing things to turn it around? And also, I'm just really curious, because I wonder, when you have morale go down, if you're not, you know, winning, how do you just get people motivated to get up in the morning, to be excited, you know, day after day, taking that long walk during the paddock all the way across. So to get their spirits up so they just don't feel like this sucks, I give up, I can't take it anymore.
Yeah, I think that's one thing is what you see on mostly on when you watch the Netflix Drive to Survive or when you watch a race, you see the 60 to 80 people who are in the paddock. You don't see the 90% who are not in the paddock, who work in the factory. And my philosophy is that you win races in the factory at home, and then the race team can only deliver the wins then, or they can only mess it up. If you don't deliver a car that is capable of winning, the race team cannot succeed and the people on the track. And if you deliver a car that can win, the race team can make it not happen to win. So the very most important is to get the home team, to get the people who have regular jobs, the designers, aerodynamicists, machinists, even the cleaners. You have to get everybody to be excited and to do a great job. And when I came to Williams, there was quite a lot of people were scared. Now there is new owners. Does the name change? Do we have another name? Will it not be Williams anymore? And I think we made it very clear, and that was also what I've seen from the questions. People work for Frank Williams. They want to work for Williams and not for any just a Formula One team or racing. They wanted to work for Frank Williams. So we made it very clear that it will be and will stay the Williams team, that we very highly respect the heritage. We will have the museum there. We will be Williams, and we want to go back where Williams has been. It's not a new team starting from scratch with a new name, and we'll do everything better. So we really made it clear it will be Williams. And in the office, we put, in my office, put photos of Frank and Claire. So I communicated, we all still work for Williams, and it's also me working for Williams. It's not then as a team principal or CEO, it becomes my team. It will be Frank's team, even when he passed away late last year, just yesterday, 2 days ago, a year ago. So that it's that they still knew that the heritage will be there. But then, you know, of course, it gives the confidence to the people, but it also then you have to break through. It's not how we have done it for the last 30 years. This is the way we will do it in the future. This is then, I think you have your plus and minuses if you do this, but I believe it was absolutely right thing to because the heritage gives you also a kind of pressure, because you know they were successful and everybody wants to be successful again. This is, I think it's a kind of pressure, but it's also a kind of really good motivation.
It makes a lot of sense. It's almost like a rallying cry to say, hey, you know what, despite maybe we didn't get as many points as we wanted to, but look back at the history. And this is what we're fighting for. This is what we're working towards. We have a storied history of success. We did it in the past and we could do it again. And it sounds like you were kind of using that as a rallying point to get everybody, you know, to think about, not think about whatever may happen right now, if it's not so great, but look back in our past and say, yeah, we've been so successful and we will be again. And this is like a new beginning. And did you notice when you did that, did the spirits lift from people when you started seeing them in the factory, you know, on the track, that started like they maybe had a more of a spring in their step than they did before?
Yeah. And also, you know, when you are at the back, you can take more risk, mm-hmm. because you can take more risky decisions. So if it goes right, yeah, you get really a good feeling from that. And if it goes wrong, so if you do everything just without taking a risk, you are in the back anyhow. And communicate that, look, this is the fun of being in the back, because you can take these kind of risks you wouldn't be able to take when you are at the front and the top. And if it works out sometimes, then you really get the people motivated. That was, for example, with in Spa last year, when we got the podium, where from the car performance, but we would not be able on merit to get the podium, but we're taking proud, good decisions and getting support from the team on those decisions, because you encourage to do stuff you not regular would do, and then getting the result, I think that gives the confidence back in the team that we are good in something, that we can beat the others, and just creates also the atmosphere, but we have to take risk. And with that, you have to also ensure that you don't have a blame culture, because if something goes wrong, I have to stand there and say, look, I supported the decision, is mine. So it's not blaming at anybody and say who did the mistake. But then look, how could that mistake happen? Did we not have the right data? Did we not have the right process? But not who did it. It is why did it go wrong and how we avoid it in the future. And I think that it's quite vital for a race team, because you have to speak up early, because the smallest problem before a race becomes a catastrophe in the race if something breaks or the car breaks down and you can't finish a race. I think that it's needed a really perfect team culture, as this is a huge team sport. Yeah, you have won the team at the racetrack, but the whole team, the whole company has to be one team and fight for the same objectives.
So it's, you know, what you're doing, being in, let's say, an underdog, you use that to your advantage to say, hey, listen, we're not in the lead spot, we're the underdog, but because we're the underdog, you know what, we're gonna take some risks. We're gonna do some crazy stuff. And because why not? We have nothing to lose, so let's just go for it. And yeah. When you do that, did that like light a fire under people to say, like, get them all jazz, say, hey, this is kind of fun. This is cool. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, not at the beginning. Yeah. And then we were, no. And but then when we had a couple of times success and got some points through these kind of decisions and acting, then it was, it's actually not that bad. And we were, the decisions we made were more positive than negative. And then they were negative. They didn't really pop up because we would be at the back anyhow. So that was, from the difference from last year to this year was that the team really proactive then came with proposals. Hey, we could try this, we could try that. Wow. So I think it became more culture and a general feeling within the team. Yeah, we can take some risk. Let's try something.
Like, what would be a risk? Like, what's an example of something you did? Like, were people like, whoa, no, don't, what? You're crazy. We can't do that. What were some things that you did?
For example, strategy at the race, mm-hmm. where you can see where you can do, if you do the same that everybody does, you end up where you are ranking. And if you are ranking in the back and you do the same as everybody, then you stay in the back. So you have to do something different, but you have to base it on data. So you have to collect data that maybe the others don't have. And then what we learned and said, look, what data do we need different to make a decision? And then when we decided this data we need, then we have to trust these data and then make a decision based on those data, even if it's our feeling would say, oh, it's different. And when it works out, it's fine. And when it doesn't work out, we have to question, not question the decision, but do we have the right data? Or do we have to change data? Or did we take a decision, but we didn't trust the data? So we did a different decision than what the data would tell us.
How do you use data when it comes to racing? Is it like, okay, here's what happens if it's raining. Here's what's happening if it's this or that.
It's a data of the weather forecast. Yeah. I think you need an excellent weather forecast. You need these data. And you also need, in free practice, you test your different tires, the different tire compounds that you can and have to use during the race. And with this, you have to create a strategy that maybe can vary from everybody else. You, for example, you do the test to have your tire degradation over time. We had this year in Japan, we got into the points there where we had really no chance. And then we took a strategy. I don't think anybody else has taken in Formula One before, but I can't tell you because it has to stay confidential. But
this was, you don't give away your secret sauce. Yeah.
This was our masterpiece and everybody was so happy and excited about it. And that gets then the team that was great towards the end of the season that confirmed us again. Yes, we can do smart decisions and can improve and can do better than actually we were actually supposed to do. I really integrate the drivers in what we are doing because if they are not supporting the strategy or what you're going to do, they will go on track and prove that they were right. Because they can mess up every strategy. If they are not motivated and they believe it's a wrong strategy, the strategy will be wrong, even if it's a right one. And that's why you need to have a close relationship to the drivers. And they are the ambassadors. They have to get the team behind. Because that's, you work with 800 people for two race cars, but finally there are two drivers who have to deliver in public and they are all alone out there. Yeah, you can have radio conversation, but they have to believe that the car is safe. They have to believe that the strategy is right. And then they can deliver. They need this extra push and the extra confidence. And for that, you need to be very transparent for me, that's a key of leadership, to be really transparent to everybody, that everybody knows what's about, why we do things, and can also openly voice issues or concerns. But finally, the race team has to all to pull on one side on the rope.
Do you think doing that, you know, getting everybody aboard, to get people motivated, to get them excited, can that trump not having the same amount of funds that other, you know, competing teams have? Could that really alter it? If you just have like 800 people who are all, you know, getting on the same team, who are really just driven, have the same vision, that over time that could overcome, you know, someone else who has a war chest of like billions of dollars to build the best cars and have the other thing. Is that something that could kind of win in the long run?
Yeah, I absolutely believe in this, because now in Formula One, you have a cost cap and you are not allowed to spend more than a certain amount. And I believe that 80, 90% or even 100% are spending towards this cost cap. And if everybody, and you have different, let's say, different history on investment. So you look at teams who could really have the resources to invest heavily the last 10 years before there was any cost cap, and Williams couldn't. So they have an advantage in the structure, in infrastructure, and this, even you now have the cost cap, it's difficult to catch up because now they start from a different level. And I absolutely believe to catch up is you have to be more efficient and you have to be higher motivated. And if you get the more homogeneous team you get and the better the team works, that's the only way to outperform teams who had more financial resources in the past. And I think that if that everybody is aware and believes that we can do it, that's the only way to succeed.
But there's so many movies that have your ethos of coming, being the underdog, like, you know, the Bad News Bears, Rocky, you know, there's just so many movies based on that premise that you start out, you're competing against, you know, people who have much more money, like Bad News Bears. This sounds so goofy. This is a movie from the 70s where a really like bad group of baseball players, kids, you know, playing, you know, regular baseball, and they're up against the rich kids who have like the best uniforms, the best bats, the best pitching coaches. But, you know, the ones who had the scrappy team that had the heart and the look, over time, they end up winning. Like, you have this whole kind of vibe of that, you know what, you know, the underdogs could win, you know, if you all get together, exactly what you're talking about, get motivated, get excited, pull together as a team, they could take on people who have way more money, way more, you know, professionals helping out, and they win in the long run. Tell me if I'm wrong. It feels like you kind of had fun being like, hey, I'm coming as the underdog. We have nothing to lose. And hell, man, we're going to try everything. And we're going to go a little crazy. We're going to take risks and we're going to have a good time. And then by doing it and then winning a little bit gets everybody, wait, what? This is great. This is cool. I'm excited. Yeah. So is that how it works? That it gets this like snowball effect in a good way, where everyone gets aboard and gets excited. And then all of a sudden the vibe shift changes to a big positive.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is. And then you have to get it from the race team on the track. Mm-hmm. You have to get this vibe into the factory as well.
Yep. Right, because in the factory too, I can imagine people could get, you know, a little bummed out if they're working on stuff and they're not winning, and, you know, then maybe they're not, just not just your team, anyone, like in any company. And this is what I love, having these conversations, because it's not just sports. I mean, this goes on for anybody who's working anywhere. You know, it's easy to get disillusioned. Yeah. It's easy to give up. It's easy to just say, I quit. So like, how do you keep people, you know, when, you know, they could be lured away. I imagine they could get lured away with big dollars to go somewhere else. How do you keep them, you know, motivated, excited, interested, and not just having their ego crushed and just trying to leave?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that you have to make sure that everybody knows that every single member of the company has an impact on the performance, everybody. So if the shop floor isn't clean, you get dust in parts, you get dust in the hydraulics, and the car fails. So it has everybody has an impact on the performance, so that everybody knows if we perform well on track, that that knows if I wouldn't have performed properly, we wouldn't have had this result. And everybody feels proud of that because everybody knows his role in the success. And this is every single one of the 800. And that you evaluate every job exactly in the same way. As you know, every job you have is vital. And if you have a job that is not vital, you wouldn't need this job. So, and then we do this, that we have after every race, we have a town hall where we report from the races so that everybody has this information, what happened and why. So then, so that they see their value in the results we have. It's not always positive. It's also some way we were not just positive. We also failed. We had also problems, but we have to share the positives and the negatives so that you can build on from the negatives and move on, and you see how good it is then if you have the positive results.
Now, is this unique what you do, or do other teams do this as well, or this is just your kind of brand of leadership and management?
I don't know how other teams do it. This is my style of leadership, and I've been successful in the past, and this is how I enjoy leadership. It's not, I think I'm not, I wouldn't do a leadership style that I wouldn't enjoy, because I think it's a better one. I have to be myself, and I have to do it the way I enjoy it and I feel it is right. And not, I read a lot of leadership books, and I wouldn't say one is 100% right, or you can copy that. And I don't think there is only one right leadership. I think the leadership has always to be, has to reflect the person, has to reflect the leader. So if I would lead in a different way, I think it wouldn't come over credible. And if it doesn't come over credible, I wouldn't get the team behind me. And so everybody has a different leadership style. And I think there is not right or wrong. It's only the right or wrong for a certain person.
That makes a lot of sense, because, and that applies to people in all sorts of careers, right? Where you have to, you know, be true to yourself. You know, if you're a certain kind of personality, yeah. you know, you don't want to go against it because it's not going to come natural and it's not going to be authentic. So, I'm new to the sport, but watching, you know, the Netflix series and seeing you, I could tell, unless you're a great actor, I could tell like you enjoy doing what you're doing. Like you just had, you know, you could just see the glint in your eyes, the way you talk to people. You could see you're just having fun doing it, no matter what the pressure is. You know, it didn't seem it got to you, and it seemed like you thrive on it. So I guess that's a big thing too, right? Where you just have to love what you do and enjoy what you do and be authentic about it, right?
Yeah, I think that's the basis, and you have to enjoy the pressure. So for me, the more pressure I have, the more I enjoy it.
It doesn't wear you down. It doesn't wear you down, like where you have the fans, the media, the PE firm, like just breathing down your neck. It's all part of the job. It's cool. It's all right. It gets you more motivated. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but also you have to be success driven.
Yeah.
You have to see that you move forward. And even if you are in the back of the grid, you have to have some measurements where you see the progress, not necessarily in points or in championship position, but where you do better, where you come closer to the other teams, so that if you get closer, you have the chance to overtake. And this is where the phase we are in, because losing for me is physically painful. But the positive good results, even if it's only one or two per season, I think for me, they are worth all the effort, all the negatives, all the failures, if you see some good results and moving forward. And these moments when you have these good results, I think they, for me, they make it all. They are worth all the efforts to fight all year.
So you celebrate no matter how small a victory, You want to really celebrate it as a team and say, hey, all right, maybe we didn't win, but like, here's what we did succeed in doing. And here's like how we achieved goals, which we didn't do before. So you, it sounds like this way you always walk away from that town meeting feeling good about yourself, you know, that there's something, some measure of positivity that you can feel proud about, right? Which keeps, I guess, everybody still like engaged with everything. But speaking of moving forward.
And you see, if you have seen, if you've seen the Drive to Survive, the Williams episode, where you see it's, the episode is about getting the first point. Mm-hmm. And it's not getting the first win. The team didn't have a point the year before. And then as you see there, how we celebrated when we got the first points, it was celebrating as if we won the championship. And this is like, oh, wow, this is a good feeling if we get the point. We want more of this. And then it gets the team, yeah, we want more of this, how we can do this, and then we can grow.
And speaking of growing, and I know you're a busy man, so I don't want to take up any more of your time, but where do you see the next season? Do you have a game plan? How do you, you know, what's anything up your sleeve that you're going to do that, you know, you can talk about?
But you know, it's like normal engineering. It's not as fancy as you don't put the finger in the air, and what we put the clear objectives for what we want to achieve with next year's car. If that is, then we want to move forward. We know we can't fight for the championship for a couple of years, but we have to move forward, and we put the objectives that we believe we can achieve with the car. And we are on a good way on the engineering side to achieve the objectives we set. If they are good enough, it has to be seen. So the objectives we set for this year, we didn't achieve with our car, and we didn't achieve the results we wanted. But so we had quite a lot of changes as well, how we approach it, how we work, establish a war room to for the development of the new car. And we have to get more efficient and get better results. So I think we are on a quite a good way to achieve what we want to achieve. And we run the company based on OKRs. And I think this is not just being happy and do every day what we like to do. We have the company OKRs broken down to each department OKRs. And we are very transparent and open with that, go through them where we are. And if the OKRs are right and the tasks that come with that we achieve, then we should achieve what we want to achieve. And if not, we have to adjust the OKRs. I think we're working there like every other tech company as well. Yeah, we are not just and that's also when we have a bad result, we don't change the strategy. So we stick to our strategy and try to deliver.
And is there anything before we go, anything that I didn't ask you that you'd like to share with the audience about the team, about your career, about any kind of advice you want to offer to people, whether it's in the sporting world or just in the business world?
I think from my leadership style, you have to have an organization, you have to have an org chart, but I strongly believe that you have to work non-hierarchical, that everybody has to talk to everybody where he thinks and needs, or he or she needs to talk to, and not going up a chain and then going down the chain, going up and then getting back, so that there is a like an open door policy with me as well. Before I joined Williams, I asked to take the walls off from the walkway to my office. So there is not even a door to my office. I'm sitting in a complete open area with my assistant, with four of us, we're sitting there, and everybody can, it's through the walkway, everybody can walk through without any access anytime. And my desk is just in the middle. And I really want to encourage that everybody can talk to everybody and not scared about any hierarchy. And what I learned for many years when I was at Ford, they called it skip level meetings, where everybody can apply to talk to me. And we have then cross-functional, cross-hierarchical group, and always 6 to 8 people for one and a half hour, where we just discuss what anybody wants to discuss. I think that it's great that everybody can talk to me, And then also there are a lot of colleagues who never met before being then in the same meeting, and then see that one department has an issue, another department had that issue, has solved it, or and can the departments can learn from each other, or that one says, yeah, we have the same issue, let's try to find a solution together. Think that it's breaking down the silos that you can have in the company, and also creates a lot of transparency, because the participants go down and say, yeah, I heard this firsthand and we had a good discussion. So I think that creates the more collaborative working environment and not hierarchy based. So I've spent a lot of time in the US, and I say many of what I have learned and what important things I learned came from Ford, because I think the Ford policy and the Ford behavior is very much like this. And I really liked this kind of environment, especially how it is in the US. And I think lots of what I'm doing now came from that learning in the US.
This is what I love doing these kind of podcasts, because I think even though it's Formula One, it transcends that, you know, and I think people who watch this, especially leaders who watch this, might say, wait a minute, maybe we should adopt some of these principles. And then people who are watching who aren't leaders, but maybe would go to their boss and say, hey, check this out. Like, it doesn't have to be, you know, the way it is. Like, maybe you should be trying to make us feel engaged and make us feel like part of a family, part of a team. So I think this is really great. I think you've offered such, you know, wonderful advice, that because with Formula One, not only is it a sport, but it's a business. And you could learn a lot of lessons from it.
And thank you very much for your interest. And thank you very much for having me.